any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get calloused and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Screaming into the Hollywood Abyss is brought to you by Scriptation, the Emmy award-winning app that instantly transfers your notes into new drafts in seconds. Scriptation allows you to digitally mark up scripts, separate notes into layers, track changes across revisions, and so much more. Insert Noah saying something nice about Scriptation.
Dan, I think this is where they actually want me to talk about how much I love it. And I do love it. It's great. Its collating function transformed me from the messiest writer in Hollywood to, well, ever so slightly less messy. My wife might have other things to say about that. Scriptation listeners can get a free month of Scriptation by going to scriptation.com/Scriptation.
For those of you who don't understand slightly drawly American accents, that's scriptation.com/SITHA.
Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure, and adversity in the entertainment industry. I am your non-entertainment co-host, Dan Rutstein.
And I am your industry co-host, Noah Epsilon. On today's Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, I'm thrilled to introduce the multi-talented music producer, as well as TV and film writer, director, and producer, Adam Anders, to our podcast. As a music producer, Adam has sold more than 100 million albums, and in recent years, he's segued into film and TV, where he's helped produce and or write such hit music-based TV shows and films such as Glee, High School Musical, The Prom, Rock of Ages, and many, many more. Adam is currently making his directorial debut with Journey to Bethlehem out in theaters tomorrow. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks for having me, guys. I feel like, all those things you say this podcast is about, I feel like I'm like a walking caricature of it, but failure, rejection, and that's my middle name, man. So I'm on the right podcast.
you are. So this is slightly
failure different. Is my middle name, right?
This is a slightly different one. This is a sort of, I guess, this is almost as live. So in the nicest possible way, you look quite tired. We're only doing the audio, but if they could see you, they would see a tired looking man who's quite excited because his big new movie is coming out tomorrow. But you're also right in the middle of it and the strike isn't helping with things. So just give us a sort of how are you today and how are you feeling before we do the real questions.
Yeah, I'm not responsible for anything I say on this podcast because I've slept 2 hours for 5 days in a row. I've been crisscrossing the country, and every time I'm walking in a airport or sitting in a car, I'm doing interviews because, as you mentioned, there's a strike, and it's coming out in 38 countries, and I'm the only one who can talk about it. So it's been quite a ride here. It was the old adage, watch what you ask for. You might just get it. I'm getting it right now, big time. What's funny, I didn't get into this business to be the one doing the interviews. I like being behind the scenes, so it's a little uncomfortable for me. But we have to do what we have to do and get this thing out to the world. But I'm a little tired, but I'm excited, like you said. Don't know what to expect. You know, the strike's been hard. This is a grassroots kind of marketing campaign for this movie, and grassroots usually includes the cast. You know, they're the ones doing it. Getting people out the first couple weeks, and then the movie has to do its job after that. But I don't know. Hoping it'll find its audience.
So I was quite sure how I managed to get into the influencers screening, but last
week... Not either, actually. Talk about that. Security was fairly light.
So I was at the that's really good. I was at the influencer screening of this movie, and you stood up before in the way that these things work and sort of told your story. And it's interesting because obviously the what makes this interesting is obviously, you know, there's this movie which is, you know, a light family musical version of one of the most well-known stories. And I think you were saying on stage that so when you were pitching this, no one could quite believe that this sort of hadn't really been done before. But I know it's been a very long journey. So let's go back to the beginning. When you had the idea to do this and you started pitching it, how were people receiving this pitch for what should be obvious as a great idea, but in the way these things work, also could sound like a very weird pitch to be making?
You know what? I have to like go back now many years because it started 17 years ago when I first had the idea, and it was just literally I was looking for a Christmas musical to watch and I couldn't find one that actually was about Christmas. So I'm like, well, that's weird. And back then I was just a music producer, songwriter. So I thought, well, I guess I'll write one then. I'll write a musical, you know, a stage play is really how it started. And little did I know it would take 17 years and be really hard. But that's what started it all. 11-page treatment that I wrote back then. It was called Road to Bethlehem, but you know, it took 17 years, so I had to turn it into a journey. I think when I first started pitching it, I think it was as far back as 2007, maybe the first time I pitched it. And I've pitched this movie for so long, I've been at four different agencies during this process. So everyone's heard about this stupid movie. They don't want to hear about it anymore. But honestly, it was pretty well received on an agent level right away. We're like, oh, this is a great idea. Why has anybody done this? Everybody said the same thing. And then you like go just one level deeper and they go, eh, forget it. It's going to be too hard. Nobody will buy this. And it was just kind of that thing over and over and couldn't get, at first I was trying to get a writer to attach and no writers would attach. So then I said, well, I'll write it myself. And I wrote the first iteration of it in 2010. And that got nowhere. Probably because it was a terrible script is probably my best guess. I haven't actually gone back to read that one. That would be a frightening experience. You just keep, you know, I just kept going. And then 14, another version. And 17, I met Peter Barsacchini. We did High School Musical 3 together. And I'm like, why don't you help me write it? And then we wrote a new version of it. And then I sold it finally based on that. But they didn't like our script. And they're like, we're hiring someone else to write it. I'm like, okay, whatever. I was never going to write it anyway. I was just happy I'd sold it. And then I got the script that they had written and I hated it. So I was like, and it wasn't a bad script. Don't get me wrong. It was actually an awesome writer who did a magnificent job. It just was completely the opposite of the movie I wanted to make. And so I'm like, well, I have to kill this somehow. So I ended up buying it back from them so I could have the rights back. And then in 2020, when COVID hit, I found myself with a lot of time on my hands and nothing to do. And I said, let me take a crack at this again. With everything I've learned over this long journey, and even a lot of things that I learned from the scripts that weren't good and even that other people wrote, and just kind of let me start over again. And so I called Peter because I felt like that version that we did was the closest. And we started over. And then out of that came this version. And I think at that point, I realized I needed to direct it. To actually tell this story the way I wanted it to be told. So it's been a long, hard-fought journey. Still is. I'm fighting hard right now. It's surreal. But here we are. Tomorrow, every theater, 3,000 theaters in the U.S. So weird.
Not only 3,000 theaters, I was doing some research before the podcast, and 3,000 theaters, including my local theater here in Hawaii. So you've made it all the way to the shores of the southwest side of the island of Oahu. Your movie is playing and we'll go check it out at some point. Of course, Dan is
already the lead that you're in Hawaii. Like, how am I not like in the studio with you doing this?
We can do that next time. We'll do this one in person. And I do want to add a little bit of, you know, I think a number of the listeners will know this already, but getting a Getting a movie launched is really difficult. Getting a movie launched where you're the writer and director is even harder. Getting a movie launched about a religious subject is where you are the writer director is, it's like hitting the lottery again and again. And it's like using the lottery, the winnings to get buy another ticket, win the lottery again, to buy another ticket, to win the lottery again. So I want to just say that the road to this is nearly impossible. And yet you have a movie going wide. Of course, life doesn't make it easy for you because you are releasing it, you know, during a strike where you alluded to it, but your actors can't promote the movie yet. Hopefully soon, maybe when this airs, it'll be over. It feels like it's happening anytime now. So maybe we can finally all go back to work. But I want to let's take us back in time. We'll come back to the movie that you just made and it's releasing. I want to hear more about that. But let's go back to what I'm kind of interested in, and is you sold 100 million albums. You were in arguably the hardest business in the world, which is music. And then you decided that you were going to join another business, which is arguably equally hard or harder or just slightly less hard, depending on who you're talking to, but very difficult. And you're like, well, I'm going to make it work here too. Some people pivot out of desperation. Why did you pivot? Because it doesn't sound like it was out of desperation. It sounds like maybe you were approached.
That's a great question. It was not out of desperation. Maybe it was out of desperation creatively, but definitely not from a career standpoint. I had a very successful career as a music producer and songwriter. I was bored creatively, frankly, and what I've seen in my life, and you probably know other people like this, that that you're always looking for something creatively. Every time I've kind of reached, I started as a bass player. Believe it or not, I studied jazz bass. That was my big dream. I'm going to be a bass player. I kind of accomplished that. I was a first call bass player in Nashville doing arena tours, Shania Twain, whatever. And I'm like, man, this is boring. Like, this doesn't fulfill me at all. Creatively, this just isn't it. And by the way, that's a really weird realization when you've spent your whole life mastering something like that. You go, wait, what? I thought this was going to be different. Then I became a songwriter. And I was like, well, I've always written songs, so why don't I try to sell my songs? And then I heard how they produced them, and I went, well, that's not very good. Why don't I try producing them? And it was kind of that thing. But then I got to the pinnacle of that, and I was like, why am I still creatively unfulfilled when I'm successful doing something that I think I love? It's a very weird thing, and I'm not a malcontent at all. I'm actually quite grateful for everything I have because I grew up with nothing. Which is part of why I've told this story, because I grew up, my parents were in the ministry and missions, and so it's a big part of my family story and everything. So it's an important story to me and my faith. But so it wasn't like ungrateful for success. I was just like, this isn't it. This isn't the thing. And I've always loved storytelling, and I've always loved movies and TV. And I said, well, why don't I start doing film and TV music? Let's do that. And so that's when I moved from New York to LA, was to pursue film and TV music. And in the back of my head, I was like, maybe that's the way one day I'll get to tell my own stories. If I can get into film and TV through music, which I'm really good at, maybe then one day they'll listen to my stories. And that was kind of the long game. And I didn't expect it to go as well as that went, because I kind of had barely unpacked the boxes and Glee happened. And that was a whole crazy Beatle-esque ride that I couldn't have predicted. And, you know, out of that came Rock of Ages and all these different things that we did. But the whole time I'm like, as successful as Glee was, I mean, we had 9 out of the top 10 on the charts at the same time. I was at the pinnacle of that career. I was like, eh. I was still like, what is wrong with me? Seriously, just this is not the thing creatively. So then I started pitching my own musical ideas, because that's when people started approaching me, like you said, because of the massive success of that show, and that I was doing the music for it, and the music was driving the success, frankly. I got approached like, well, do you have any other musical ideas? So that's how that pivot naturally kind of just happened. But it wasn't I was kind of heading that direction on my own, but then everything kind of came together in the right way. And I was able to slide over to that and pitch my own ideas and started selling them. So I started selling TV shows and movie ideas. Some I got to write, some I didn't. I didn't try to direct any of them. Saw many of them butchered. You probably know what that feels like. having a, you know, writing what you think is like the best script you've ever written, and then you see somebody you've directed and just make it the worst movie you've ever seen. That's a really terrible feeling too. Which, by the way, is one of the main reasons I said I'm going to direct this movie. I'm not going to let that happen to this one. So that was kind of my journey through all that stuff.
I like staying in chronological order, and I was going to stay in chronological order, but I want to ask a question because you're in a really unique position where you said you were creatively discontented and then you wanted control and you got control, meaning you wrote and you directed a movie and you were in that weird place because it hasn't come out yet. So your dreams are still eclipsing what might or might not be the reality of, you have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow, right? And you're waiting for that to come out. What is your emotional state at this second? And would you say you're happy? Like, you're happy with the process because you're still in the sort of Shangri-La place where this can go anywhere and be anything. And did you make the movie you wanted to make?
I'm miserable right now, frankly. but I'm very content. It's an interesting, contradiction, I know. But that's where I find myself, because I've had the most creatively fulfilling year of my life making this movie. It's been the hardest year of my life because I'm a first-time director, and you have to fight and claw for everything. Every day there was a battle, and that's exhausting. I also didn't have enough time. I didn't have any money to make the movie. It was just very, very hard. But I just, like, I have to make this movie at all costs. It doesn't matter what it takes. And, you know, I'd move away from my family for 6 months. I moved to Spain to shoot the film, so I didn't see my family for 6 months, which is crazy. It was really hard. That's the thing people don't think about, you know, when you go make these movies and do these things. There's such a sacrifice going on behind the scenes. And then we're so quick to, you know, to judge a movie and say, well, that movie sucks, that guy's terrible, whatever. I'm like, you try doing it. It is literally the hardest thing you can do, make a movie, start to finish. It is unbelievable how much work it is and how many people have to work on it and be rowing in the same direction for it to actually come out and be a good movie, you know, because I have to then convince the studios. I have two studios, financiers, and all these people, and everybody has opinions, and you're wrangling all that. And I mean, it's, you know, you've been there. It's a nightmare. But thankfully, I did have a studio and a financier that believed in my vision for the movie, which was very helpful. And probably, frankly, the fact that I've had such a long career maybe gave me a little more weight than a typical first-time director. I produced a lot of big movies and TV shows, so I had more power probably than any other first-time director, just in the sense that they trusted me because they see my track record. And I have good taste, and I kind of know what I'm doing, and I know what good looks like because I've been around good, you know. But it was hard. So I find myself now with the strike, which, by the way, Murphy's Law, 17 years, and it lands right on strike. You know, I'm like, really? That's just fantastic. God has got a sense of humor, I think. But it's hard. What I'm most, I think, content with is the movie I made. Very happy with the movie. You know, somebody told me going into this, if I got 70% of what I wanted in this movie, it would be a success for me personally. And I can honestly say that I have about 90%. I didn't have to compromise that much. I got to make my movie with the time and money I had. You know, it's like Hitchcock said, you know, movies aren't finished, it's abandoned, which I fall into that category too. Sorry, you're out of money and time. All right, I guess I like it. But so I wouldn't say I know it's not going to be a blockbuster tomorrow. I know that it's too small a movie and it has the finest audience. We didn't have a big P&A. So it's really gonna be a word of mouth movie. The reason it's coming out way before Thanksgiving with a Christmas movie is to give word of mouth a chance, to spread into Thanksgiving. And then hopefully we can pour some fuel on the fire at that point. But I don't know what to expect. I'm just very proud of it. I'm proud that I finally got it done after all these years. And I'm just trying to take the W, you know, take the win. As you said, it's like, it's a miracle that I finished this thing, because it's a musical nobody wants to make. It's faith-based, which nobody wants to make. It's a first-time director, which nobody wants to let make a movie. It's just everything was stacked against me, and we still got made. So definitely want to celebrate that, whatever happens tomorrow.
Oh, that's a fantastic answer and insight. Now I made this point about sort of winning the lottery. I want to talk about the religion part. I know they say you should never talk about religion, but we sort of have to on this podcast. So in terms of it's a really, you know, it's Journey to Bethlehem. So it's very obviously about a religious subject. There's obviously a balance one has to strike between it being religious enough that, you know, you don't offend your parents, for example. And I think you made that point before your remarks. But obviously not so religious that it becomes something that should go on the God Channel and not be in 3,000 movie theatres. So I don't know if there's a God Channel in America. I think there used to be one in England.
I think it's called something. Yeah, there is something.
But also, I guess...
So, the joke is Fox News, but we'll just keep moving.
So how did you maintain that balance? And I guess of the notes you will have got along the way, how many of them were too religious, not religious enough from the various people involved?
Truthfully, very little. They knew what they were getting into. You know, they signed up for the script that I'd written that you can tell what it is. It is not a Bible thumping movie. It is not. I just felt like I just wanted to tell the story of Christmas, right? Whether you are a believer or you're not, I was like, it's for everybody. I wanted to make Elf, but about Christmas. That's really what it came down to, right? Something where the whole family can gather, you know. And by the way, when your whole family gathers, some may be believers, some may not. All of them may not. They're from all walks of life, whatever. What can we make that everyone can enjoy? And then it actually be about what you're celebrating. And so the goal was to make that movie, you know, I would say, you know, Affirm, which is the faith-based division of Sony who's distributing it, you know, they have a very narrow audience that they go after. This movie is actually way more broad than that. So there was some tension in that, because I feel like this is a very mainstream movie that I made, but they very much want it to be, you know, for the faith audience. So there's some tension there, but they never forced me to do anything, frankly. They were really good partners. For me, it's walking that line. You know, it's never going to be Christian enough for some people, and it's always going to be too Christian for other people. I can't make everyone happy. It's impossible. So what do they say? If you try to make everyone happy, you make no one happy. So, you know, I made a movie that kind of was what I wanted to see, and hopefully other people agree, you know. But it's definitely to be my first movie to pick religion, musical, period, in another country, you know, all these things. I'm like, what was I thinking, man? I should have made like a soccer movie. I don't know. That would have been much easier. But no, it's interesting. I've found that when I've been screening this movie, everybody likes it. It's not like only Christians like it at all. And that makes me really happy because I made it for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to give away the plot, although you can probably guess it, but I am from a religion. I'm not Christian. I'm from a religion that doesn't feature a lot of Jesus. But I've enjoyed the movie. I took it at face value. I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I must admit. But I very much like the posters. They were designed by my friend. But still, I very much like the posters. But I figured I could guess some of the elements in it. But, you know, I enjoyed it as a family movie. And it didn't feel too religious. But it obviously, I could got the sense that it was religious enough for some of the people in the room. So, question. How did you get Antonio Banderas into this movie? Because that feels like there must be a story there.
There's a big story there. He has no business being in this movie. So, you know, look, I always had him at the top of my list since COVID. 3 years, I was like, this guy would be amazing as Herod. I kind of wrote with him in mind, you know, this Herod character, this kind of a what Johnny Depp is to pirates, you know, Herod is to kings, you know, is kind of what I have in my head. And I know that Antonio can sing. His song was really difficult. And Antonio was in Phantom of the Opera and all these musicals. He's just phenomenal. He's an incredible singer, unbelievable range. And he's so charismatic. He's such a rock star and a movie star. But he can be evil and he can be super charming and he's good looking. All these things that I wanted, he encompassed all of it. So I'm like, well, let's just try. You know, what's the worst you can say? No. Which they did. They said no. The manager's like, no. Not how you can't afford him. Not happening. But, you know, 17 years, I'm obviously tenacious. So we kept going back to the manager. Well, just read the script. So we got the manager reading. He's like, I actually liked it. And he's like, I'm like, I told you. Okay, listen to the song. He's like, I really like the song. Send the song to Antonio. He sends the song to Antonio. So we're getting somewhere. Antonio says, I love the song, but I can't sing that high. Forget it. I'm like, okay, I know he can sing. So that was not going to deter me. So we keep hounding this manager. And at this point, the studio has another person to play the role, a very big actor. And I was like, that's not the guy. And I was freaking out a little bit because I'm like, this can't work. And, you know, was it Ilya Kazan that said 80% of directing is casting? I totally agree with that because I'd seen it so many times on my shows and movies. When they got the cast wrong, it was just unfixable. So I knew that that would be a disaster with that particular actor, who's a phenomenal actor, by the way. It just wasn't right. So I'm like, crap, I got to go back to this agent, this manager one more time. So we're pushing hard, and he goes, it's not happening. He's directing and starring in a play, and he can't be bothered with it. So we're like, well, where is he directing and starring in a play? And I had just moved to Spain, to Madrid, to start prepping the movie. And he goes, well, he's in Madrid, so it's not going to happen. So I'm like, well, that's not a coincidence. So I'm like, what theater? I'll be right there. So it wasn't quite that easy. We started buying tickets to his show. We just went guerrilla style and started stalking him and going every night to his show. My producer just kept buying our tickets. You know, he kept showing up. He'd go or I'd go. We'd all go. And then finally, my producer was at the bar or something in the theater and started talking to a guy. And it turns out he's one of Antonio's best friends. And he's like, well, I want him to be in this movie. This sounds great. I'm going to text him. And then he goes, well, come back tomorrow. He'll meet with you. So we go back the next night. I text the manager, like, what do I need to get him to say to do this? And he said, get him to say, talk to my manager. I'm like, okay. So we're sitting there. It's a 4-hour play in Spanish. Then I had to sit through a 2-hour Q&A in Spanish with film students. So we're now 7 hours into our journey because I had to get there early to meet this friend. It's 2 a.m. and here comes Antonio. I'm completely fried. I'm so tired. And I got like 3 minutes with this guy to pitch him. So I gave him my best elevator pitch. I don't know what I said, but then he got to the song part. I can't sing the song. And I pulled out my little piano and my phone. And I go, you've been hitting this note every night that I've been coming to your show. And that's the same note that's in the song. And you're doing it live. And you don't have to do it live in my movie. And he's like, huh, okay. And he's like, do I get to play the bad guy? I'm like, yeah. So I pitch him the Herod character. And he's like, you know what? Talk to my manager. I was like, yes, we got him. So we were floating home at 3 a.m. And it was an amazing thing. I mean, to get somebody like him, he's such a movie star. He elevated everything around him and everyone. And it was a really, really great moment for us.
Amazing. Look, this podcast
is a long story.
That's the sort of question you normally get asked in sort of, you know, the junkets for movies. But for this podcast, I wanted to ask that question because I think for the layperson, they've got no idea how this works. The fact that you know, you spent 17 years making a movie, and that's just to get one person, albeit a particularly important character, to show the effort that goes in. I think that just gives a sense of sort of how hard these things are. And if you could send me 6 numbers, please, by tomorrow, so I could go and buy some lottery tickets, that would be appreciated.
Yeah, right. It's a pretty remarkable thing. And he was amazing. He bought in completely. And I knew that he was a man of faith too. I mean, he's a very devout Catholic. And I knew that he lived an hour from our set in southern Spain. I'm like, there's just too much going for us like this. I've got to be able to get this to work out. And you just can't give up sometimes. You just got to push, push, push. And he did his EPK on set. And they asked him why he took the role. And he said, because he came to my show. You know, so... You know, it's just little things sometimes. It's pretty cool.
If somebody asked me advice and was like, I have a script and I think Brad Pitt's going to be perfect. And Brad Pitt's is starring in a play right down the street from me. So do you think it would be a good idea if I went to the play every single night and stalked Brad Pitt to get him to read my script? I would probably say no up until this podcast. Now I have to change my answer.
Because I've started a really bad thing. Now, everybody, remember, I was in talks with the manager. It wasn't in a vacuum. He knew I wasn't some psychopath. we just kept going in the hopes that he would come out one night and talk to us. And I'm like, well, I'm right next door. I'm not going to take the, I'm going to try. If he, just on the chance that he decides, okay, fine, I'll talk to this guy. And we were there and we did it. So yeah, please don't stalk people. That's really bad. It's usually a terrible way to get people to do anything. And don't walk up to them at like Walmart and hand them a script, please. Just don't do that. It just doesn't work. It goes in the garbage.
Agreed and agreed. Okay. So we have you at a fascinating time because you're right in this bubble. The movie's coming out, this huge thing. You work for 17 years and maybe we'll get you back on after it's come out and it's hopefully done fantastic. And we can talk about the roller coaster you're on now, but what happens mentally for you at this point in regards to your career? Your movie hasn't come out, but you've done a major movie. Your agents are beginning to think about positioning you somewhere. Are you saying, I want to direct another movie? Or are you saying right now, I want to sleep for 6 months, see my family, and then I'm going to think about what's coming next? What is that process for you?
Well, definitely my agents are pushing heavily for the next movie. Look, like I said, I found my calling making this movie, which was crazy for me at my, I'm in my 40s. I've done a lot of things, and to like, go, wait a minute, this is the thing I've been looking for. So I can't walk away from that now. I'm stuck. I'm hooked. So I want to make more movies. I did walk away from a very successful career to make no money to make this movie. Huge risk. I just had to do it. So it is what it is. But I'd live in a trailer park and still make this movie. That's the reality is. And I think you have to be that way. You have to be sold out to the art. And I've always done it for creative reasons. I've never chased money in my career. I just haven't. I've just always chased like the thing that fulfills me creatively. And there's always something in me going, no, go do that. Go build that. Go make that. And money has come. It's been fine. I don't know if money will come this time. But if no money comes, but I'm fulfilled creatively and I know what I'm doing, what I'm supposed to be doing, I can live with that. But I started talking about my next idea to my wife yesterday and she shut me down and said, don't talk to me till January. So I think it's going to be January, which by the way, for the record, I wrote all the music, in the movie with my wife. Like our first date was writing a song together and 26 years later, we're still writing songs together. So it was very much a family affair too, which by the way, when I moved away for 6 months, that helped that she was a part of it and that it was a family, decision and not unilateral. I think I'm stuck making movies now and directing. Nobody will hire me because they hate the movie and I suck as director. But I think you saw the movie. It's not horrible, I guess. So.
Talent aside, because that's obviously you're talented and you've done, because you've succeeded in so many fields. What do you think is the key to your success? We're a failure podcast, so I apologize in advance because I'm not asking about failure, but it might be connected. I mean, are you not scared of rejection? How do you rise to the top in every one of these fields that are almost impossible to even get to the middle?
Because of exactly that. I've already accepted failure before I start. I'm okay with it. I mean, when I pitched my first show, I was like, what's the worst they can say? No. And they did. I'm like, okay, well, that Band-Aid's come off. And kind of my mentality has always been every no is closer to a yes. And, but 100% the secret is that you have to be okay to fail. If you're going to take these type of, risks, and a lot of people aren't cut out for changing careers and walking away from success to chase the next thing, whatever it's not for everybody. But I'm okay to fail. I'm not okay not to try. And that's just kind of how I live my life. I have to try or I'm not going to be able to sleep at night. When they bury me, they're not burying me with my house and my accolades or whatever, but I'd like to be near the end and go, I did the things I wanted to do. I wasn't afraid to try. Even if it doesn't succeed, if this movie doesn't do well or doesn't live up to expectations, I think it's going to do something, but I don't know what that is. I have to be okay with just having made it. That is a huge victory. I got to the finish line. I got it made. And I think I have to encourage people two things. One is learn from your failures, because I failed on this thing for 17 years over and over again. And I learned every time from that failure. Rather than just take it as a failure and quit, I took it as a failure and a learning experience. So I definitely encourage people to look at it that way. Of course, you also have to admit if it's just a terrible idea too. There's a balance there, because not every idea is good. And I've had, you know, as creative, we have ideas all the time, and that doesn't mean they're good. And if one doesn't work, you usually walk away from it and go, well, that was a bad idea. Let's go do a new one. This was just one I couldn't let go of. I knew I had to make it. So, yeah. So I think the process itself for me is a victory. The fact that I got it here to the end. But like I said, I'm okay. It's not going to be fun if it's not well received and if it does horribly. And of course, it's not fun. That's not what we want. But I'm very proud of the movie. I know it's a good movie. I've been around long enough to know bad. That doesn't mean that people want this movie. You know, I don't know. I can't control that. So, yeah, failure is a great teacher. That's all I know. It's a very good teacher.
So I want to ask, it sort of links to your answer, but I want to ask a question about, so last Friday night. So you've been working on this thing for 17 years. You're in a room with, there are obviously some, you know, hard-hitting, very important influencers there, like, you know, like myself. But there's also a lot of, you know.
You were the biggest by far.
Yeah, I think that might be right. But they're obviously, you know, friends, although obviously a lot of the cast, I think there might have been a couple of cast members, but a lot of the cast weren't there because they're not, you know, they can't do anything on the carpet. But there were lots of friends there, but there's obviously lots of family there. Now, some of the family had obviously worked on the on it, like your wife, but there was also, you know, your parents and your kids. And you referenced it at the beginning in your speech, and then obviously it came up at the end that you put, you know, you mentioned your parents and your kids in the credits. Mm-hmm. That, can you talk us through that moment? You're in a room, whatever it is, 200 or 300 people, many of whom are very close to you, who have just watched this thing, maybe not for the first time, but they've all watched it in, you know, literally the Oscars theater. And then, you know, a very personal moment at the end of the credits where you're referencing, you know, where you began and then your offspring. Just what did that moment feel like?
Yeah, it was surreal. First of all, how amazing is that theater? It was really a divine place to watch that movie with my parents for the first time. Frankly, they'd never seen it. It will never sound or look better than it did there. It was a very special night. I think there were 500 people. Very few, way fewer friends than I would have hoped, because everybody, all my friends are in SAG, frankly. So everybody stayed away. Really heartbreaking to not be able to have the cast there because they deserve to be there. So it was bittersweet in many ways. But I think it was really kind of magical, because when that came up on the screen, because I kind of alluded to it in the beginning, just I told my mom and dad, like, hey, just stick around for the credits. I have a surprise for you. And everybody stuck around to see what the surprise was, I guess, because they cheered when it came up on the screen. So it was a really awesome moment. My parents were very touched. My dad's very ill. And frankly, I didn't know if he was going to be around to see this movie. And I kept trying to figure out, should I send him the movie before it's finished on link just so he can see it? He's in Sweden. And I didn't do it. I just felt, no, I want him to see this the right way the first time. And so it was really awesome to have him there and to be able to dedicate it to him and my mom, who I got my creativity from. You know, they're great artists. They were Royal Academy of Music grads in Stockholm, and that's where they met. And been a huge influence on me, both as a person, obviously my faith, musically, creatively, work ethic, you know, all the stuff that you're supposed to get from your parents, I guess. And we're not all that blessed. So to be able to thank them it was just a really special night. And I really was having a hard day. First of all, the press junket was brutal by yourself because it was so much. So I was so tired. Knowing the cast couldn't be there, I was very emotional because, like, Fiona, for example, she deserves to be on the press junket. She deserves to have her moment because she's phenomenal in the movie. This is her breakthrough role. And Milo, this is his first theatrical release. It was just very emotional for me that they didn't get that moment. They're not going to get in. This movie could be out of theaters before they're allowed to talk about it. And that's just a tragedy. And I don't think it's okay. So I have a lot of feelings about that, but they've been very much punished, you know, for something they didn't do. So I was very emotional. And that was even more emotional. So basically I was a basket case, I guess is the best way. I'm surprised I remembered you, frankly. But I do. You must be just a very recognizable face. I don't know. Maybe it's the hair. I don't know. But man, what a journey. And to, yeah, like you said, I didn't even think about that the way you just said it, you know, where I began and then now my offspring, my boys, who I hopefully made proud. That's the cool thing about the movie is not many musicals boys like, but I had to make a musical that my boys liked or I wouldn't hear the end of it. So that might work out nicely for me. I don't know. But I don't know if that answers your question, but.
No, it does. Look, we're definitely near the end of this podcast in the beginning, which you'll be relieved to because this must be your 100th interview of the week, if not more. So just one more question from me and then Noah's going to wrap up. So, you know, this movie that comes out this weekend, you know, your name came up about 7 times, I think it was, in the credits before and after, because you've written it, the songs, you're the director, you're as the producer. I know you said that, you know, you've sort of finally found your calling and this is what you want to do next. But in the weird way these things work, will you be disappointed on the next movie if you're only the producer or only the director or only the writer? Or do you actually want to do sort of 7 different very key roles yourself again?
You know, that's a really great question. I don't know. I've never directed someone else's words before, so I guess I'm gonna have to try it to see what that's like. I know that it was very natural for me to write and to direct as far as the screenplay. It was very easy for me as a first-time director to explain to an actor what the intention was, like what's going on in this character's mind, you know, what's happening. That was very easy for me because I wrote the words. As far as the music, if it's a musical, I don't think I could stand not doing it because I would never think it was good enough. And I think I don't wish that on anybody to do the music for one of my musicals. That would just be torture for them. But I don't necessarily only want to do musicals. I enjoy the dramatic scenes in this movie as much as the musical scenes. So I think if anything, I would remove producer from that list, music supervisor from that list. Things, the stuff, the day-to-day grind stuff that I just was so exhausting, contracts and all the stuff. And I was dealing with so much stuff that wasn't creative while I was doing all the creative for the movie. And that was too much. I wouldn't do that again. It almost killed me, frankly. And it's still stuff lingering and things you have to do as a producer. And so I would probably remove a couple of those titles for sure, but not the creative ones.
Well, thank you for your, you know, these honesty. And I had just texted Dan in our chat saying this is absolutely one of my favorite episodes that we've got done. So you got to the heart of why we do this podcast and your vulnerability and your success, frankly. I mean, you're the perfect mix of somebody who's emotional because of the toll of your journey while riding a wave that will hopefully lead to tremendous success. And you've already had tremendous success. So thank you for coming on, which does unfortunately lead me to my last question, and this is the question we ask everybody that comes on this podcast. And if you could give one piece of advice to somebody joining the industry, and you've done a lot of things, so you can pick music, film or TV, director, writer, what would that be?
Be honest. I think that's probably been my superpower my whole career, is that I'm not only honest with others, but I've been honest with myself. And I think we lie to ourselves too much. We drink our own Kool-Aid. When we're not successful, it's always everyone else's fault, but it really probably isn't. You can probably do a better script or do a better song or do better something. So be honest. And I think also being honest with others, the reason the actors trusted me as a director is because I've always been honest with them, you know? So I think honesty is just something nobody talks about in this business. And I think it really is such a superpower if you can harness it. And just don't lie to yourself and don't lie to others. And I think you'll go far.
Brilliant. Thank you. I mean, look, and I know I said it was one of his favorite episodes. This feels like the sort of case study you do when you're doing an MBA. It's not like the story of your career. Like, we're in the middle of it. You're between the influencer screening and the big moment. And the fact that you're tired and a bit emotional, I think, has made this an exceptional episode. So I really appreciate your time when I know you're incredibly busy. I think I'm obliged to say to people that obviously they should see the movie, but they should watch the trailer first because it was made by our mutual friend Jason, and they should look at all the posters because they were made by our mutual friend Janice, which was great because at the end of the wrap party, or the party you did downstairs, they made cookies with the artwork on it. So that was a very exciting moment in these weird way Hollywood have to come up with new ways of doing
it. Only Hollywood can get you to eat your own work.
Yeah, so she was literally eating her own work at the end of it. It's, you know, as a British person, I was very excited when Melchior came on the screen. And it was a comedian I grew up watching. And it's the same that Amin Jadali can't be doing promotion because he's brilliant and he would be great at promoting this movie, as would the rest of the cast. And as you say, it's a shame that you don't get that, but hopefully the strike is over while this is still in theatres.
You know what? Hopefully it ends today and they can at least, we can get a shot in the arm on release day. You know what? It's not over in the first weekend, so they'll have their opportunity to talk about it, I hope. And go check it out. I mean, it's a really fun movie. I'm very proud of it. And I appreciate you guys having me on. And Journey to Bethlehem. Here we go.
Thank you. And your journey to Bethlehem is a brilliant story. Very well told. So thank you very much, Adam, for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Screaming into the Hollywood Abyss, brought to you by Scriptation. Thank you, as ever, to James Launch for the music. And thank you to our loyal listeners. And if there's any showrunners out there who want to hear their fellow showrunners abused and ruffled around and put under the microscope so you can hear their stories of rejection, failure, and adversity, please send them our way. If you are interested in following us on social media, no, I've lost track.
I am at Ann Ebslin on Twitter or X or whatever Elon Musk now calls it. And thanks to Elon Musk, I'm also at Noah Ebslin on Hive, Spoutable, Blue Sky, Threads, Mastodon, MySpace, Friendster, and I'm sure 1,000 more.